Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 391. It's a very big day. Today, Sunday, August 4th, the day that I am recording this intro. Geek Week on YouTube launched today. The Nerdist channel was producing with a bunch of YouTubers some Geek Week programming for a week. And go to youtube.com/Nerdist right now, and you can see today we posted Slash's 10 favorite horror movies and an animated version from our friend Jackie Dan Show, who animated a bunch of Nerdist podcasts, who decided that he wanted to animate Patton Oswalt's filibuster rant from Parks and Rec. So that's up right now, youtube.com/Nerdist. Go check that out. Lots of programming. Also, I'll be doing stand-up in the month of September in Minneapolis and San Francisco and Boston. Go to nerdist.com/calendar to get tickets and info on that. And the 12th Doctor was announced today. Peter Capaldi, who is kind of a legendary veteran British actor. He's a Scot. Was in a band with Craig Ferguson called the Dream Boys in the early 80s. So if you dig around, I posted a link to it on my Twitter feed. Just their album cover is incredible from the early 80s. And also, he played Malcolm Tucker in The Thick of It. He's been in a million things. He was in Torchwood, Children of Earth, and also was in the same episode of Doctor Who that Karen Gillan was in, The Fires of Pompeii. So he's a fantastic actor. Yes, I am excited about it because it's been so long since there was an avuncular doctor. You know what I mean? So I think he's going to be fantastic. And of course, I'm sad to see Matt go, but we're always sad to see them go. But happy when a new guy comes in and takes his turn on the doctor. I don't know what type of neckwear. What could his signature piece of clothing be? Could it be tails? Could it be leather gloves or spats or a tie made out of a squirrel? I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm sure that we'll all be wearing it at Gallifrey 1 and all the cons next year. So in short, very excited about Peter Capaldi. You should be too. Change is hard. That is the nature of Doctor Who. We must move on. And so we shall. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, Stamps.com. Okay, pretend that there is a pile of money in your hand, and now imagine throwing that into a garbage disposal and turning it on with the water running and just hearing it turn to sludge and then go down your drain. Now, that would be a lot of fun, because if you could do that and not care about it, you're a millionaire. Congratulations. But if you're not, that is what you're doing when you're leasing one of those expensive postage meters for your small business. There's a better way. Use Stamps.com. All the benefits of a postage meter. A fraction of the cost. Use your own computer and your printer or your printer and get official U.S. postage. Any envelope, any package, any class of mail. No more trips to the post office. Everything you need right from your desk with Stamps.com. So there's a promo code, as you know, special offer, no risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist at Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. This episode is Michael C. Hall, who I was thrilled finally came on. I met him at a party last year and sort of poked around it, never thought it would actually happen, because I'm sure everyone now goes up to people and goes, hey, will you come on my podcast? But it did happen, and he came on, and he was, first of all, hilarious. He is an hilarious man. Yes, I said an hilarious man. I'm using that article, that antiquated article. And then also, this episode got real in points, which we've been doing lately. I feel like we always did that, but I feel like it's been happening more lately, and I'm kind of enjoying it, and I hope you are too. Of course, we're mid-swing into Dexter right now, if you're listening to this August 5th, which is when this episode's going up. So this is the final season of Dexter. It's got to be weird after all these seasons to just let it go. And so, tying the Doctor Who. The 11th Doctor's leaving, and Dexter is leaving, and then Cranston's leaving. Breaking Bad, which starts next week, is a very... we're saying goodbye to a lot of things this year, a lot of characters that we love, but Michael C. Hall was a terrific guest, and you shall enjoy the Nerdist Podcast number 391 with Michael C. Hall.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
That was
already started.
He's not allowed.
I want you to know, Chris, he tried to sit in your seat. We stopped it.
No. I mean, you got these guys trained.
Yeah.
Like here, I'd say a foot and a half away, and it was like, da.
You know, I don't really care where I sit. I always just sit here because
maybe I feel like it would.
It's
mess
a power
up the
position.
Rhythm.
That's why you sit there.
It's not. You
is
know,
it? We're
you have your back
table.
In the corner like a mob boss.
Yeah. You're where the maid guy sits.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I like to sit at a restaurant.
In the Art of War, on the chapter on podcasting, it always said to have the corner at your back because that's a stronger position.
Yeah. Well, I say I have the worst seat.
Yeah. Snipers.
You're open to snipers.
I mean, yeah.
We can push you out the window.
Oh, but I do have that.
You have an oil painting protecting. Mm.
I think I take this seat because I can see when people come up the stairs if someone wants to come. I don't know. I feel like I have...
Power position.
I guess that's true,
I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Reiser's underneath the chair.
Well,
Paul Reiser's underneath the chair.
Paul Reiser's there to just kind of give him a good,
I've assembled you all for a reason.
Mad about shoe.
Got that razor blade lever.
So there must be a Dexter panel at Comic-Con this year.
There is, on the 18th.
That's Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, Hall H.
Yes.
How many more episodes are there? How many more episodes are there?
There are 9 to go. 3 have aired.
Shit.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So it's gonna be
and
last
we just
Dexter.
Wrapped it up. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. It's the end.
That feels weird to me because to me in my head, I mean, I've watched since the beginning. It still feels like, oh, it's a new show. Like, no, it's been on for like 7 years.
Yeah, I know. People are like, oh god, it's it. Well, you guys had a good run.
Come on, we actually did have a good run.
I mean, 8. It's beyond that is rude. I mean, it feels.
Are you listening, like, Frasier?
No, he's probably not.
You're thrilled.
Probably not. Doesn't
you're
care.
Thrilled that Frasier went for so long.
11 seasons. The last two were in HD.
A spinoff too.
Yeah. No, I mean, come on.
But then those last 3 seasons, you get into like fuck it money, where they're like, here's $1.2 million an episode. Just keep doing
for
the show.
26 episodes.
God. Oh goodness. I mean that's mind numbing to consider until you think about the money.
Oh, the money.
Yeah.
You'll toss all the salad and scrambled eggs you want.
I just think it's...
I don't know what I would do.
I think it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know.
You go to, like, how could you get mad at anything on the set at that point? You're like, hey, how come this coffee's at... Ah, I just made $1.2 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it even matter at that point?
I don't know, man. I mean, I find that being an actor, one thing that's nice about it is if you act with the just baseline modicum of civility, people are like, he's so nice.
Yeah.
He's not a tyrant. You know, like people, one of the things that I won't miss from Dexter is how many times a day people say, sorry. Sorry, you know, if they perceive in any way that they're in your path.
About 5 years ago, I fixed your computer at the Apple store.
Oh, yeah.
You had the top case.
How many dick pics on his computer?
70.
70 dick
all
pics.
All of the same dick. just different angles. Yeah. It was weird.
Yeah. He's trying to make a 3D image.
Well, yeah, I actually made a flip book.
Just to animate it.
And he actually
it goes
said,
up, it goes down.
He said someday 3D printing technology is going to catch up.
And it did. Yeah, and he was right. He was absolutely right. It's sort of funny, though, when people...
No, he's very nice. He wasn't a dick then.
No, thanks for the plug.
Sorry. There's something funny about when people try to, like, telegraph your emotion that it actually... kind of puts you in that mood. Like, oh, you mad? I'm sorry, you mad? And you're like, I don't know why I'm getting mad now.
Yeah, maybe that's what
before.
Happens with actors. Everybody starts, they're like, yeah, you should be sorry. Why isn't everybody apologizing more?
I think it's, I don't know what it is. I think people just take, this business in particular is sort of a festering chamber.
Yeah.
And I think sort of whatever you take into it, he's going to fester. If you're a nice guy, you might become a nicer guy. If you're a douchebag, you'll probably become a bigger douchebag.
Yeah. And I do think maybe people were more inclined to say sorry over the course of Dexter because he's thinking about killing people. He's thinking about...
How much is seeping
alone,
into his psyche?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
How much of this... You know, but I always like to talk to actors about this where they... is the idea that you can portray a character and it might access parts of your... brain or your emotions that you don't really want to that you don't really want to understand, where you start going, oh yeah, I guess this sort of makes sense. I mean, this guy is just a guy.
Yeah, and the theory that there's some part of your brain or some sort of your cellular recording apparatus that doesn't distinguish between real life and ritual.
Right.
You know, and that there's some part of me that thinks I really did all that.
There is a bit of a weird thing that happens when you watch like a lot of episodes of Dexter in a row or a lot of episodes of Breaking Bad in a row, where you kind of, you're watching this guy just constantly lie to people and have this other stuff going on, that you kind of feel that way when you walk out into the streets. You're just like, oh, I could just lie and no one will be no one will know. And it's like,
well,
it's
as an
real
actor, you could do that anyway. You're basically conditioned to, oh yeah, I could just lie to people. And
that's what acting is, professional lying.
It is professional lying in a weird sort of way.
Right. And somehow convincing yourself within that you're telling the truth.
Yeah, exactly. It gets very gray. But it is also, you know, coming up 6 feet under or Dexter or, like, you know, these are just like really complex layered characters where you spend a lot of time in your own
head.
Well,
yeah, I certainly think after 13 years all told with those two characters, maybe I haven't been discouraged from being a navel-gazing, scatterbrained doormat. I don't know.
Your next project has to be just some weird frat guy comedy, like one-dimensional, almost as a sorbet to, like, you know, to cleanse a little bit.
That's a good title. You seen that frat comedy called Sorbet? It's like this French. He's on an exchange.
Foot in the D, I believe they call it over
it's
there.
It's a frat that has to go sober.
That's what it is.
No more beer, says the dean.
Is it? I mean,
man,
it must be kind of nice though that when that show takes up the majority of your year, I would imagine probably. Almost all of it, 9 or 10 months, maybe, right?
Honestly, no. It's more like half the calendar year.
Really?
Yeah, but I don't know. There, it's a constant presence. You know, you're still, if you're going to do another season, somehow tied to those train tracks.
Yeah,
waiting to be run over again. I don't mean to sound negative.
You spend 6 months doing it, and the other 6 months fearing doing it again.
Six months in Long Beach is a long time.
It is. There's a lot of trips to Long Beach. Early morning trips to Long Beach.
Wait a minute. That's in Miami.
No. In fact, when we go to Miami to get B-roll footage, we look for places in Miami that look like Long Beach. So it'll all match.
You just need like an ounce of authentic Miami stuff. Like,
just go for the ports.
It goes a long
way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we would go once every 2 years, and I'd drive around and change clothes again and drive around some more and just look preoccupied and think about blood. And
this is all the VO at that point.
Yeah.
What are you doing right now? Just think about blood.
Yeah.
What's up, blood?
When in doubt, you're filled with blood. Think about it. Feel it. Think about it. You like it.
I mean, for a show, this show has that type of narrative structure where every year you kind of have to – well, this last threat was the worst threat that we had ever seen. Yeah, this next you year, always we gotta up it again.
You have to up the. I mean, I think we upped the ante up to a point. Mm-hmm. I don't think we were ever gonna have a big bad as formidable as the Trinity Killer.
Right.
So really, the Dexter was traumatized as a character, and the show was sort of traumatized in terms of what it was.
Yeah.
And so it became and has moved towards maybe something else that definitely changed its course. But yeah, yeah, you have to either up the ante or reboot the system or whatever the
that
hell
Lithgow
you say.
Was amazing.
Strong.
I wasn't expecting to like the big bad after like Smits. Like Jimmy Smits I thought was such,
oh
like,
Miguel Prado.
But just the insanity of that character arc.
Oh yeah,
was
remember
insane.
That scene with them on the roof?
Oh when he was like shit, when he
am
finally,
I allowed
like,
to curse?
Yeah, yeah.
He was like, I will fuck you back. And he made that gesture hitting his bicep. It was
insane.
That was some of the most fun I had on the show was actually playing a character who could act as if that didn't scare him. It's like that's the most fun. Like I'm unfazed. In real life, I'd like I shit my pants.
Smits does not age either.
Yeah,
that guy. He was on fucking L.A. Law.
Yeah.
In like 85.
Yeah, and he looked like that.
He looks exactly.
Wait,
the same.
I thought he worked for the New York Police Department. Blue.
Nope. Yep. He's done it all. Smits. So when you're working with these guys,
Captain Antilles,
he's a great guy.
It is your show. Ultimately, it's your show. But when when guys like Lithgow come on, is it intimidating at all, or do you sort of feel like, no, this is my house? It's
you know, in the same way that no, it's not intimidating. It's invigorating. It's like pinch yourself. You know, the first time I was in the transpo van after one night where John and I had both shot for the first time, I was actually seeing him come out of a parking garage. So we didn't exchange any dialogue, but I got in. It's just like, how is this happening? You know, I mean, I'd always admired him, and it's like in the midst of something beyond your imagining. It's a heady thing.
Yeah,
that's some Raising Kane Lithgow.
Yeah, well, he brought the dark back. You know, he'd done the Broadway musicals and the sitcom for
the
10 or 15 years. But he was in fact, in Long Beach, a lot of times parents would come out of their houses with books of his banjo music.
Oh, really?
And he'd sign them. Yeah.
Sign of Trinity Killer?
Was it dog?
Yeah. He's done it all. Yeah, it was pretty trippy within the context of making that show, seeing the kids flocking to him. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's an incredible guy.
Well, he's one of those guys that's of that sort of era of actors where they basically did everything. They do really broad comedy, but then also just get super focused and dark and creepy and he's just fucking amazing.
Yeah, he's really able to convey an amazing spectrum between silliness and horrifying.
Yeah.
And managed to even work in a lot. I think Trinity was so great because he was silly, because it was John.
Yeah.
Like the way he sat there watching the football game before he broke his
kid's pinky finger.
Damn. He was like, oh, what a play! It's just like, this guy. You know, how can all that coexist? But he makes it plausible.
So what do you think is, you know, like when this is all done, do you want to take a break? Do you want to do something wildly different? Do you want to, what do you think you want to do?
Both of those, yeah. I mean, I think my wants are pretty defined by what I feel like I ought to want. I'm not sure what I want to do. I'm actually going to go do another movie in upstate New York, sort of an epilogue about a guy who in the first scene shoots an intruder in his house.
Whoa.
So I'm going to go and do a little epilogue playing a real person who kills somebody and had no desire to, and see how that feels. In a way, I think I can atone for my sins. But yeah, people have been asking, like, how does it feel? How does it feel? I'm like, it feels, you know, it feels sad. I feel vaguely depressed. I feel happy. I feel relieved. I feel prideful. But I think ultimately, I was thinking today, I repress how I feel as Dexter. You know, that's kind of his thing. And I'm sort of feeling like, oh, God, it's all just kind of hitting me.
Yeah.
I just pretended to kill a lot of people.
It was fun.
You got to go to pretend jail now.
Yeah, pretend jail. In upstate New York.
Yeah, well, and then also, I mean, in a way, you're basically, you know, you're killing him in a sense. Like, he's basically this guy that you've been carrying around that's going to not be there anymore.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, there's, I mean, it's the classic actor thing, but if you've been doing it for 8 years and your idea of the character and acting are fused somehow, when it goes away, it's like, okay, now I can be myself? Who's that?
I was actually, I was thinking the other day that you, all the stuff I think you process in retrospect, I don't think you can really identify it when it's happening or as it's happening. That it's like, I wonder, like, you know, when you look at kingdoms and eras and they go, oh, it was a golden age. Did they know it was a golden age at the time, or just in retrospect, did they look at the data and go, oh, I guess this was a golden age? Like, you just don't know at the time until you look back and get some perspective on it.
Yeah, I think the prevailing feeling at work, like, towards the end was just all of our individual projections into the nostalgia we know we will at some point feel. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just kind of like, yeah, this is going to... But in the moment, you can't really process it.
When you do the Dexter TV movie in 20 years...
Yeah. It will be called Harrison. And I will have died, and I will be the ghost of Dexter.
You know what I would do?
What?
That would just be what your character would say to Harrison.
Oh, Harrison's
coming to terms with being a serial killer.
Right. That's good. And it's can I use that? You know what I would do?
No, you can't.
Okay.
You can't use it. Because you scoffed at me when I said it.
No, I didn't. I wanted to know what you would
more.
Do.
He thought there was
You know
more.
What I would do? I would say, you know what I would do?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Then it's sort of this weird Jedi thing where it's you and Harry and then young, you know, like the dark.
Yeah, and it just keeps going. And eventually it's like Russian dolls.
You're all nesting just inside each other. Generations of murderers.
Wonderful.
What do you do in your free time? How do you scrub it off?
I've got a trip planned on the Appalachian Trail with some cousins
and
my uncle. That's not until March, but I'm looking forward to that.
A long way to go.
Yeah.
Try to exercise. Try to be as boring as possible, really.
Do you feel like you're boring? Do you think you're boring?
No.
Not at all.
No, I don't. Do you think I'm boring?
No.
I don't have a lot of hobbies, I'll confess. You know, I could be better about that.
Yeah.
My hobby is my work. I mean, well, actually, that's not true. It's my vocation, but
it was a hobby that then became a career.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
I know that's the idea. Like, I know that's sort of the perfect scenario is like, hey, turn your passions into your career. Is there any part of it though where you go, oh, but then it's a chore and then it's work? And
I don't know. I mean, I definitely feel like I'm getting away with something having a career as an actor. I just hoped that I'd be able to go out to dinner sometimes and support myself as an actor. Anything that's happened beyond that, beyond like working consistently in the theater, is sort of beyond anything I imagine. So it's pretty heady. I mean, I feel really lucky. I'm definitely, carrying around some dark characters, but my life wouldn't make sense if I didn't get to do that.
Well, and it's not a lot of people can go from one show that's a hit show right to another.
Yeah, you're not supposed to. I stepped in shit twice.
I mean, that's the sort of that's the Cranston thing too. Like, oh, he did it. Oh, and then he did this other thing that was totally different.
Two different, very different types of shit, though.
One's lighter.
Yeah.
More. Yeah. Now I'm gonna stop.
One's named Frankie Muniz.
Yeah. It is pretty fun to watch. You know, like if you were to watch Malcolm and then Breaking Bad back to back, and you see the and I think he does Broad amazing. I think he was so great on Malcolm.
He was hilarious.
Yeah,
but then to watch how fucking subtle he is on Breaking Bad, where you're just like, I can't even fathom how did he react in that moment. Where did that come from? That was just the slightest thing that you know that he was able to turn on.
Yeah, well, everything's different. It's a completely different context, completely different story. You know.
Do you feel like the environment sort of informs the character, or do you feel like the character in this case sort of spills out and informs
the
environment?
Well, I think the character definitely would inform the environment more than average on a show like Dexter, because it's subjectively told, you know, and you're encouraged to see things through his eyes, and you're implicated because you hear the voiceover and everything, and you're kind of on the ride with him. I mean, you know, I've heard people say about this season, like, why won't Deb just get over it? It's like, good Lord.
They're not arguing
really
about money.
Yeah, I know.
You didn't owe her. You owe me $20. You haven't paid me back.
Yeah, and that's you know, all due to the fact that we're just sort of maybe increasingly in spite of ourselves. I don't know. I think the affection for the character has been challenged, but you're still kind of hoping he manages to work things out.
What do you think it says about our culture that almost every protagonist on every great show that I can think of is fatally flawed mm-hmm. in some way, you know, whether it's Mad Men or Breaking Bad or Dexter or Game of Thrones, like anything.
Ray Donovan.
Right. Any character, any sort of main character now is really fucked up inside.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, people do what works, what worked, what has been working. There is more of an appetite for more than just one. I mean, Tony Soprano is there and everything followed.
Yeah.
In terms of the current trend of anti-heroes, I mean, yeah, it's really the way to do a show now, it seems. Though that might be waning, I don't know.
Yeah, well, because it just seems boring when someone's just good-hearted through and through. I mean, yeah, that's like Superman. It's kind of boring.
Yeah, audiences discovered an appetite to be given permission to identify with characters who are more inherently flawed, as we all are, yeah. And I think relished it and yeah. sort of want more of it.
It feels, you know, feels more real.
Yeah.
You know.
Have you gotten any weird fan letters like, you really justified my desire to kill people? Like, is there any sort of weird element to that?
Thankfully, no. I mean, I guess the thing I get sometimes is, you know, I got somebody who you could, you know.
Oh, Jesus.
And I say, stop right there. Don't tell me.
You know, I'm an actor playing a character.
No, for the most part, people seem very, very much aware of that. Or they're just, they don't have, the people who talk to me don't have skeletons in their closet and don't feel like they would be a worthy victim for Dexter. So they're just happy to say, you know, go get him, buddy. We're all for it.
Have at it.
It is setting up a system that basically allows people to accept murder. It's like, oh, well, he's killing the worst people in the world, so it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think in as much as people are desensitized to that fact and questions about responsibility and everything, you know, I mean, I certainly think about what the show might be reinforcing. And I think ultimately it's not a primer to yeah. be a serial killer or advocate the lifestyle or anything. But yeah, if you're seeing things from his point of view, he's certainly, in his way, desensitized to murder. So I guess you will be too if you take the ride.
Well, I just think, as a narrative story, it's to take any bunch of fucked up circumstances and then try to find humanity in the most fucked up circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like that's a real artistic challenge, and if you can get people to empathize with that person, that's a really cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah, and maybe it sort of feels good if in the midst of all that suffering you can derive some sort of meaning from the story being told. Then,
yeah.
Then maybe life has inherent meaning everywhere.
Yeah. I could totally cut this out if you don't want to talk about it, but you survived cancer. Are you willing to talk about it at all?
Sure.
Probably the one thing that I, and then it's also because I've been watching all the Breaking Bad episodes over again to get ready for the after show.
Yeah.
And every time it's very hard not to like, you know, it's basically, I just think of that as like, well, that's the worst news that you could get.
Yeah. It was towards the end of the fourth season and I had these swollen lymph nodes in my neck and I thought maybe it was a cold because I had a cold, but it was unlike my normal cold. And I went, the doctor took a look at him. He told me to come back in 2 weeks if they weren't gone. And I came back in 2 weeks, and the next morning I got him taken out. And the next day I found out, while I was driving down to Long Beach, that it was cancer. But I was immediately told it was, you know, something that was given my other prognosticators and their ability to treat this kind and the stage and everything, that I was going to be fine. You know, like 93% chance. So immediately I was like, well, I have JV cancer. I can say that because my father died of cancer, and you know, it really my sense of survivor's guilt. I was like, man, it is really deep. I get cancer too, and my first thought is like, yeah, but it's not like the kind he had.
Oh, what was the kind? These crazy dad issues.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Never live up to.
Yeah, and I've done two characters who are have conversations with their internalized dead fathers.
Oh my God, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any part of you that is there any part of that that's cathartic in some way or odd or
it's cathartic up to a point, but after a while, it feels like you're tilling soil that's long dead.
Yeah.
No, I just mean like it's, you know, it can get indulgent if you don't separate it from it to a degree if you play a character that long.
Sure.
But you know, in the end I feel blessed to have, you know, been called upon to explore those issues in my work and as much as I have been.
Yeah, because most people with other occupations are never going to be in a situation where they can actually pretend that you're talking to your father, and what would that conversation be? And like, no one ever gets, you know, like the people just don't get that closure. They just ball it up.
Yeah.
So you knew right away that you were probably gonna be okay in it. But it's
I did. I didn't mean to. Well, I didn't mean to, but I did sort of divert from
that's
the story.
Okay.
But yeah, I did. I mean, it was amazing what you can make room for. That's what I learned. I mean, I found out and just like, okay, well, I guess that's what's happening. And what do I do? And you know, I got an opinion and three second opinions, second, third, and fourth opinion, and decided on a course of treatment. I did 6 months of chemo every other week. But, you know, my doctor impressed upon me, like, you know, when my dad had cancer in 1982, there were 4 chemo drugs, and now there are over 100. And in terms of kinds of cellular abnormalities they call cancer, you know, I had the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so you know it was a specific condition, and I was encouraged to believe that immediately, and was, you know, my mind was more at ease as a result. I mean, it wasn't fun. Desmond Harrington on the show, when I told him about it, he was like, "Yeah, you know, you're gonna have wet pants. You're gonna have wet pants for like 6 months. I mean, having wet pants sucks, but you know, it's not gonna kill you."
Well, was that weirdly comforting?
Yeah, it was good. Whenever I felt bad, I was like, "That's just wet pants."
That's not a big deal.
So irritating, though, wet pants.
But does something like that, does everything else become not important, or do you crave to care about dumb shit? Like, oh, I just want to only worry about things that aren't life-threatening.
I had the luxury of dedicating the time of my treatment to nothing but my treatment. It coincided with our hiatus. And I wore a wig for the 5th season because my hair had fallen out. But aside from that, it was in remission and I was feeling good again by the time we went back to work. So, you know, I thought, oh, maybe I'm going to have all these epiphanies or whatever. But really, it just became about like, okay, let's just do this. You know, what do I have to do today? And, you know, you just get through it. But I felt lucky to have good health insurance. I felt lucky to be off work, you know?
And do you feel like that's how you approach most of the stuff in your life? Are you a pretty easygoing guy in that way?
I don't know that I'm easygoing, but I don't know. There's probably, when things get tough, there probably is some sort of stoicism that kicks in. I probably got it from my mother.
Yeah. I wish I had that. For some reason, I tend to freak out until it's not, and then I don't have to freak out about it anymore. And then I'm like, oh, I guess I have to freak out about that thing. But I think a lot of people condition themselves to think that they have to freak out about stuff rather than just being able to step back and.
Yeah. And well, you know, if you freak out about stuff and stuff ultimately always works out, there's probably some trick your mind plays like, I do have to freak out, otherwise it won't work out.
Yeah.
Only if I freak out will there have been no reason to have freaked out.
It is a slightly I think there are shades of there's a little OCD. It's a little bit of OCD, I think, which is that idea of, you know, when you're in a situation that you can't control, is finding things that make you think that you're in control of a situation that you're actually really not that much
in control of.
Right.
Yeah, that's just like when I have to put my keys at the corner of the table, otherwise I think I'll die. That's the same thing.
But you may be joking. Are you serious or are you kidding?
No, every night when I go to, like, I had them up, like, I was so fucking tired and I was just getting into bed and I realized that my keys were, I was like.
That's your thing? You have to put your keys in the corner of your table?
They have to be on the table that the mail is on. Otherwise. Like, I can't go to sleep. I'm like, everything's going to be fucked up the next day. And I also have to cross the street in a certain spot. It's a weird thing. Don't worry about it.
Well, that's okay. You're just giving us tips on if we want to kill you. Like, we just know what to upset in your life so that when you go out to your table confused about where your keys are, then pop, that's where we get you.
If you park a car weird on the street, I can't cross where I need to cross, and that's a whole problem.
I dated a girl that used to think it was funny that, you know, when she would reach over when we were eating at a restaurant and just slightly move the knife askew a little bit, because I'd be like, don't do that. Like, I'd always have to move it back, and she thought it was hilarious that I could never just let it be.
That's not very loving.
Well, it didn't work out. It didn't fucking work out.
I'm not surprised.
God damn it. What the fuck was her problem? Can't the knives just be straight on the napkin the way that they're supposed to be?
That just sends that electric current right down that groove in your brain.
Right? It really does. Yeah.
That's how Dexter feels when he kills someone.
I totally get it now. At first I was like, I don't know if he's a good guy, but, you know, now I understand.
But he's just trying to... That's the only time he feels anything.
He just needs his keys to be there.
So you're very similar to that character in a way.
I'd say, in many ways.
Thank you, Jonah.
So is that essentially the only time that that character feels anything? That's basically what he's doing? Is that what he's acting out?
Yeah, I don't think that's the place where he's feeling. I think that's the place where he's comfortably numb. That's the place where, at least initially, I mean, a part of the story of Dexter and killing is that his killings become, you know, when we met him, they were just this cold, sterile, make no mess. I mean, he gets off on getting the confession and everything as part of his ritual, but ultimately I think it creates in him a sense of calm, and his kills have maybe gotten more and more personal as the show has gone on, so I guess it's evolved. But I don't know, Dexter and feelings. Ooh, don't get me started. I don't know where to start.
And just think, in about a year? No, maybe about a year. You will not have to talk about it anymore.
Correct. I'm like Dexter's press secretary.
Oh my God, I never thought of it that way. Yeah. Of course you are.
Yeah. Well, I have to keep my mouth moving and give you the sense that I'm giving you an answer without telling you anything. At least when it comes to promoting the show.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way. You are the PR guy.
Yeah, and I have all these esoteric talking points. I can't tell you how many times I've said, you know, he doesn't wear a white hat or a gray hat, black hat. He wears a gray hat or a formidable dark side. I've said them today. People relish the opportunity to be given the chance to identify.
Well,
it's hard.
I mean, listen,
I've said that
I don't
so
want to
times.
Make you talk. I didn't want to make you talk about Dexter.
No,
the whole time,
it's okay.
But
I actually brought it up.
I just wanted to talk about it a little bit because I watch the show.
Separation anxiety.
But I also do understand that, you know, I mean, particularly one thing that I think we like to try to do on the podcast is just get people to talk about things that they don't normally talk about. Because I think it's more fun for...
Well, I am talking about Dexter, but I don't normally talk about the fact that I talk about him the way I talk about him.
So it got very meta in that sense.
Word.
But then you're going to have to prepare for it again because you're about to go to Comic-Con, and then it's like, that's the nest. That's where it fucking happens.
Yeah. Nobody knows what's going to happen, man. It's crazy.
Who does Ralph got... Ralph?
Oh, guys, I think we just unplugged the Michael C. Hall soundboard. We got to plug it. Hang on. Oh, hit gray hat again?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, man. You're walking without a tightrope now. Wait, no, you can't walk without a tightrope.
You can walk everywhere without a tightrope.
Okay.
Anywhere you want.
It's just called walking.
Yeah.
I think it's the safety net they talk about.
You're walking without a tightrope.
That's a title for a book, though. That's a title for a book.
Yeah, the guy that just walked across the Grand Canyon.
It's saying something that sounds deep, but actually has no substance.
He's walking across the Grand Canyon, no tightrope.
No tightrope.
He's going down and back up.
He's walking very fast at about 9.8 meters per second towards the floor of the Grand Canyon.
That's true. It does get pretty steep.
How do you view the? How do you view the world? Like, is it like
Whoa.
You?
Jesus Christ! Look how deep.
I'm gonna back up and give you some history.
No, no,
I'm gonna
that's
back
okay.
up because you are sort of in this position of cultural power that you may or may not want.
Yeah, no, I could. I mean, I'm gonna try to use my powers for good.
I appreciate that. I'm thinking of like Bill Murray is a guy that kind of, I think, is aware that he's Bill Murray and just sort of floats in and out of these weird social situations because he has control over them and people will always let him do what he wants to do.
Right.
And I think in certain cases you sort of have that same thing. You're this character who's part of our cultural fabric. You can sort of pop in and people will accept whatever it is that you do. So how do you, when I say how do you view the world, like, what does that mean to you?
The fact that that is at least to a degree true, mm-hmm. that when I walk into a room, if people recognize me,
yeah.
they're like, oh,
yeah,
there's that guy.
Yeah, that you're basically affecting people when you don't mean to.
I try to, it's impossible to deny it. I try to think of it as an opportunity to maybe give somebody a good experience they wouldn't otherwise have. That's easy enough if somebody wants to say hello. But I also try to keep it in perspective and struggle to or strive to recognize that it's fundamentally unreal or something, you know, that's more like a spiritual angle. But I don't know. It's again, it's like something you make room for. I mean, I know 6 Feet Under started and I got recognized by people and it just started to happen more, you know, and it's a part of the deal. I mean, I guess it never really bothers me. I think it's only bothersome if I feel like it's impinging on the experience of whoever I'm with. You know?
Right.
But, yeah, you're right. I mean, I could come in and just bust out an Elvis impersonation and then walk out again and people would talk about it. Have you heard that story about Bill Murray where he comes up to someone and does...
Covers their eyes?
It covers their eyes, and then he's like, no one will believe you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And runs away.
Like, guess who? I don't know. It's like, it's me, Bill Murray. No one's ever going to believe this happened.
It's pretty great.
And then, like, popping into karaoke bars in New York.
Yeah.
He'll do that.
Yeah.
Yep, wiffle ball games. The guy just...
It's grassroots.
He just
stuff.
Does whatever.
Yeah.
He's really living Groundhog Day, where he just can run around and do whatever. Like that idea that, you know, at a certain point, after decades of the kind of work that he's done and where he... That he I think that's the best way to live out the rest of your life is being able to run into a room and fuck with people in a non-threatening way and then leave. And then it's just this weird legend
only
forms.
Well, back to you, what do you want to do? I'm starting to come up with something. I appreciate it.
Is that it?
Yeah, I'm just going to cultivate weird idiosyncratic behavior.
All you need is
social
like
behavior.
20 or 25 more years of doing stuff, and then I think you earn that place as.
So I have to work for 20 or 25 more years before I start showing up in karaoke bars. I can't start tomorrow.
No, you're not allowed to do that.
Okay,
that's like walking
enough.
Without
you
a tightrope.
Save me up. Yeah.
If you were to go to a karaoke bar, what would you sing?
Kiss by Prince.
Oh, that's
I would sing Prince by Kiss.
Shit. You guys should go up one after another.
I would sing Two Princes by the Spin Doctors. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I would sing Kiss Me by Sixpence None the Richer.
Oh, man. See, we're exactly the same age, so these songs populated our college experience.
Yes.
That's what I just saw. World's End, Edgar Wright's movie with Simon Pegg.
Oh, no way.
And it a lot of it goes back to taking place in like 1990. Like they're constantly having these flashbacks from 1990. And the soundtrack to that movie is every fucking British alternative hit that was college.
Stone Roses.
For me. Stone Roses. Yeah. Yeah, every one of those. What was your soundtrack in college? What was your...
In college? Henry Rollins Band and Jane's Addiction and
shit. You liked cool music. I had a Belle Biv DeBow tape.
Belle Biv DeBow is different, but it's cool.
No, it's not.
I went through I don't know. I think when I got to college, I maybe discovered music that I hadn't listened to because of, you know, whatever I missed out in high school. So I started listening to Pink Floyd in college. I'd never really listened to them in high school. It was a little after the fact. But
where'd you go to college?
Earlham College. I always say it in the form of a question because it's a really small school. And,
and you expect people to go,
Indiana.
Where's that?
Yeah. Earlham College? No. Well.
Nothing?
Yeah. Nothing? It's a little liberal arts Quaker college in Richmond, Indiana.
So you should
Quaker
say...
Quaker affiliated. I mean...
Quaker adjacent.
Students aren't all Quakers.
You should say it very demonstratively so that people feel stupid for not knowing.
Oh, Earlham
went to
College.
Earlham. Went to Earlham College.
Went to Earlham.
Well, oh, is that? Oh, oh yeah, yeah, of course. Oh, yeah.
Earlham Una. Oh, college. Early Earlham College. Yeah, yeah, of course, of course.
That's a very Quaker familiar. League school.
It's great. Amazing faculty. Truly.
What are the Quakers like to coexist with?
Well, I mean, you know, there were probably 18% of the students were actually Quaker, but probably like a lot of Quaker institutions, like the more secular side of Quakerism pervaded the community philosophy, decisions made by consensus and things like that. Yeah. There was a meeting for worship for the college, you know, where you, you know, sit in silent worship unless your inner light moves you to speak for some reason.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah. It's kind
of
cool.
Did you absorb any of the Quaker philosophy?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, it's a kind of philosophy that maybe wouldn't be able to work at a larger institution. You know, Earlham was well suited to it. But yeah, the inclusiveness of their sort of spiritual aspect or worship style is very appealing.
Do you think you took that to work with you? Because you did say you're pretty nice to work with on set.
Yeah, I mean, if someone's moved to speak, I'll listen to them.
Sorry.
But it's a weird responsibility to essentially carry, like, to carry a show on your shoulders in the sense that whatever mood you're in, whether or not you realize it, is essentially going to affect everyone else.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And, you know, I think, you know, I directed an episode this season, and it was kind of nice. I was worried that I'd be, you know, at cross purposes and feel overwhelmed or whatever, but I wasn't, and it was nice to have to be available to everyone and have to be decisive so that other people could do their jobs. The show and the character definitely allow you to... I mean, you guys, when you're at work, you can't just walk over into the corner and stare at the wall when everybody's like, well, he must need to do that. and I've been doing that for like 7 years. So if I'm in a heavy mood, you know, it I think it's pervasive, but I think it's more like people just give me space to be in my mood.
Sure.
You know?
Well, especially on a show like that. Like if you were doing a really silly comedy and you're like, I have to go stare at the wall, like, what the fuck is that guy's problem?
Yeah.
How long?
Lighten up, Kramer.
Seriously, lighten up, Kramer.
Jim Kramer, Mad Money.
Oh yeah, that's what he's talking about.
Was that directing an episode something you had been trying to do for a while, or is it like it was until this season? I should do it before it's done.
Both. It was an invitation that I hadn't taken advantage of on a couple of occasions because I had other commitments that didn't allow me to do prep. Then another time I was just like, I'm too tired. I don't want to do it. And this season I realized it was the last chance. And so I did it. And I enjoyed it. It was fun than I was afraid it wouldn't be.
Yeah, because you see that in like Mad Men and even Breaking Bad.
It's
like
common.
It's like, yeah, those, that, you know. But the thing is, like, those are bigger ensemble pieces where it's like, you know, you are always on camera for the most part.
True.
And so it's like, I'd imagine it's like even tougher just because it's like you have to keep your shit in order as well as everyone else's.
Yeah. I mean, if you've been doing it sort of was an invitation to be, you know, it's not like doing a movie where you're playing the character for the first time. You know, I've been playing.
Yeah.
So it was almost a chance to be a little less precious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just, and, you know, trust your instincts and get that done because you got to get the day.
Yeah.
You know? Well, you know the world pretty well, too.
Yeah. And I know what it looks like. I mean, while I couldn't look at shots, I know the look at the show. And even when I'm on the show, if you do a show for that long and you watch it, you know what you're in.
Yeah.
You know what it looks like.
And also, it is, you know, even though the show is called Dexter and you're the central character, it's a pretty fantastic ensemble cast.
Incredible.
Of people.
Everyone is fantastic. I mean, and there are, you know, so many actors on our show who could, you know, be stretched in ways that they're maybe not stretched on the show. I mean, there's so much like deep acting talent in every one of those people. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, even just this season, there's been such funny scenes between the characters Quinn and Batista, where it's just like
I love those guys together. Yeah. I think my favorite shot in the episode I directed is just them getting out of the car and walking down the sidewalk together, because they each of them in very different ways have such distinctive ways of moving. It's very funny. Yeah.
There's been a couple scenes with them this season where I just go fucking spin off with just those two guys.
Yeah.
I just make it a comedy where it's just those two guys as cops in Miami. It would work so well. It's like you said, it's just very different things going on when they're in the scene together, but they work so well.
Yeah.
So all the episodes are shot now. Now they just have to roll out. Do you sort of feel like it's just a waiting game now? It's like, oh, just wait for these to come out, and then it's all going to be...
I don't know. I mean, it's particularly interesting because it's the end, so, the final episode will be airing. So that's exciting, in a unique way. But I don't know. It's nice when the episodes air. You feel like you're working when you're making them, and they air, and you kind of feel like you're still working, even though you're not working anymore.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's that time of year. I mean, I've been blessed to be able to say that, it's become a part of the calendar, the show coming out.
How much of a responsibility do you think a show has to its audience where, you look back at finales and as an audience, you kind of want them to answer. They're never going to answer every question that you have in your head.
Right.
But then there's also the Sopranos ending where it's like, you decide.
Yeah.
It's up to you. Yeah. Whereas Six Feet Under is like fucking one of the best.
Well, that's probably the
show
spectrum
ever.
Between something that isn't definitive and is.
Yeah.
And Six Feet Under was sort of teed up for that, I mean, every show started with a death. That finale was great because I felt when I read it, and I think people when they watched it, it was simultaneously a shock and so obvious. It was like, oh, of course, oh my God, they're doing this. And it works so
they're
well.
All dying.
Well, because it's you sort of get to play the card, which I'm sure a lot of creators want to play, which is like, we get to kill everyone, but in a way that's totally acceptable and organic within the story, where everyone's like, oh my God, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Matt worked in a funeral home.
I did.
Really?
For 4 years.
What kind of stuff did you do?
I was a funeral assistant, so I did everything, removals and bombing and
butt stuff.
Like
right.
Butt stuff.
Some butt right. stuff.
You got to plug it occasionally, throw on the rubber boxers, have a good time.
Sure. Oh, you really do, don't you?
Yeah, it'll leak. Of course it'll leak.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Your muscles aren't doing the same thing anymore.
They're doing nothing.
Yeah.
They're deteriorating.
You're walking without a tightrope.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the title of my memoir about working in a funeral home, walking without a tightrope.
Playing it safe.
I thought your memoir was going to be the Myra method, how to be self-destructive.
That's my self not help book.
Oh, okay.
That's my unhelpful self-help book.
You've worked around so much death-related material in the last 13 years.
Chris,
no, not you.
Oh, sorry.
Shut up. But
what do you mean?
Well, just
just kidding.
Do you feel it? Son of a bitch! Son of a bitch! How dare you on my show?
This interview is over.
How dare you take the reins? These are my reins.
Come on, let me sit over there with you.
You want to just squeeze in?
No, I'm not.
You want to see what it's like in the non-captain's chair?
I want you to pull that razor blade lever.
Would you ever want to do something like this? Do you like doing host driven stuff at all, or
it's fun hosting. So I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I like free form, long form, conversational style. What we're doing,
yeah,
that's fun.
Have you gotten to do a lot of it?
I don't know. I did. I've done some. Some of the longer form, like public radio, longer form interviews and stuff. This is a little more decidedly boisterous, or I feel so boisterous now.
tell us a little bit about when Dexter's feeling near the end. Is it good?
Well, I think it's a really stew of things. I think the spectrum has broadened between his darkness and his light, and as he's moved toward more nuanced and cultivated sense of his humanity, the darker side of his nature becomes all the darker. because now we're watching someone who's becoming a human do these things. And it really implicates, you know.
You know, you were fucking around. That's actually a really good answer.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
He's got them all cocked.
It's all cocked
and
loaded.
They're all in the chamber. Yeah. It's ready.
But I was going to say.
Button number 12.
Does,
the thing you got to know about Dexter is.
When you, but just the idea that, you know, you've for 13 years, you've done these characters that are so, like, that hover around death. And then, you know, you had this experience and, which obviously worked out okay, but. Do you feel okay about your mortality at this point? Is it, did it condition you in any way to, like, you know, it's everything's will be fine?
I don't know. I mean, I think I have. I'm inclined to sort of gallows humor, or I don't know. The fact of my, your, and all of our inevitable death is something I'm theoretically comfortable with.
It's kind of funny, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of funny in a way. Like, there's nothing anyone can fucking do about it. There's no alternative. There's no alternative. It just is what it is.
It's the common denominator. Thank goodness. You're all going to die. Good night.
Michael Z. Hall says, you're all dead. How did you?
Why was he in a 20s newsreel all of a sudden?
I don't know.
Michael C. Hall says, you're all dead.
This just in, everyone's going to die. It's just a fun...
That's what our boys think overseas.
Yeah. Say hello, boys.
You'll swallow anything if I say it like this.
Take that, Mr. Hitler.
Things are going well overseas. Back home, it's everyone's having fun. The danceteria.
Get your victory gardens ready.
Oh, the danceteria? Where you have to dance for your meals?
Yes, exactly. Times were tough.
Were you just doing the trumpet with the...
Yeah, thing? That was some sort of accompanying band. Yeah, yeah. Maybe that was a slide. Yeah.
What is
that thing you put in the trumpet?
Oh, a mute.
A mute, yeah.
It's that, and then that's then it goes into a Tommy Dorsey orchestra thing, and then we come back and talk about it. I think Dexter would have been a fucking amazing radio play. Dexter would have been a fucking great radio play in the 40s. Maybe that's one of those things.
I don't think the 40s were ready for Dexter.
No, well, okay, maybe thematically.
I gotcha.
Maybe not. But.
That would be a really irresponsible way to use a time machine. you would shake up the world.
What's bugging you, Dex?
I'm going to just get in all the dark passenger stuff, and then just kids are crying next to their radios.
Yeah.
We really couldn't, as a culture, there must have been a layer of darkness in our culture that people just didn't acknowledge or talk about.
They
pushed
it down.
They did smush it down.
Along with feelings.
There's
and...
that story of like the day that the BBC ran out of news and they just played piano music, which happened in the 30s,
I think.
That'd
be great if, like, you know, Fox News just like, well, that's it.
Nothing today, folks. Enjoy yourselves.
Yeah. Except this Wurlitzer organ. Do you remember?
It's just a girl in a hula hoop just staring dead-eyed.
Do you remember when there were organ stores in every mall?
Yes.
And they went away.
Right.
There used to be one fucking organ store in every mall that had all those
giant...
There was
always an organ store, yeah.
And then you could hear, like, the... And then, like, the guy who worked there would play them.
Yeah.
And to, like, you get lured in, and everyone had those giant fucking organs with all the switches, and then they have completely vanished.
Yeah.
What
did they do with all the organs? Where did they go?
I imagine people are still buying
organs.
They're
all at the Rose Bowl flea market.
Yeah.
That's
where they are.
Yeah. They would have had to have been disposed of somewhere. There was a chunk of my life that I distinctly remember between the 70s and the 80s where every one of my parents' friends had one of those organs in their house.
Well, organs and pianos were, like, it was required. Required furniture in any house.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's like, you look at so many old pictures.
That was the entertainment.
What?
That was the entertainment.
Yeah,
yeah. Would play it.
Yeah, exactly.
Those organs were the internet at one point. That's all we had.
Don't compare everything to the internet.
It is. I thought you didn't want me to compare everything to organs.
I was on organ for like 3 hours.
Come on, man. It's sucking up your life, bro.
He's spending all of his time on organ. And I don't mean...
What's your favorite What's your favorite sub-organ?
Samba. Nice. Although now I can't listen to any of that. If I ever hear that music, it's still like Sex and the City has ruined. Like, it's always just that now. And I'm like, whenever, if I ever pass a restaurant and I hear den, 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 and I just expect them to be talking about blowjobs or something.
That's
such a Miranda thing to say.
You're the fucking Miranda.
I don't know the difference.
Okay, I don't either.
I could be any of them. I wouldn't be able to tell you.
I actually did watch a fair number of those episodes.
Yeah.
I went to the movie.
On purpose?
Yeah.
The premiere, you paid to go see it.
I went with my lady at the time and like a lot of her friends. All but one of whom were female.
Really?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
It was long. But it was, you know. I don't know. I don't know what the message was. I don't know.
What is the message?
Hey, guys, what are we really trying to say here with Sex and the City 2?
If you build a woman a big enough walk-in closet, she'll forgive you for anything.
I guess that's true. Maybe. Did they get together in the end? I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you slightly did. Pleased that that happened?
It was a nice walk-in closet. I mean, I understood why she forgave him.
Do you have time to... Do you watch stuff? Like, what are you... Are you a fan? Do you get to...
Yeah, I mean, when I'm making the show, I don't watch a lot, you know, to be honest. But I did watch all of House of Cards recently, which I thought was pretty amazing. What else have I kept up with? The new Sesame Street season is
pretty good this year.
Tight.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty sweet this year.
I like the direction.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
darker.
It's all about directions.
Yeah,
yeah.
Left.
They're making Ernie a murderer.
Yeah,
it's pervasive.
Yeah, and only Bert knows.
No, I think it. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, Bert turns out it's his dark passenger.
No, I think it'd be Grover.
Yeah,
I think Grover would be the murderer.
No, it'd be Snuffleupagus.
No, Snuffleupagus isn't real. Technically, he's real, but he's not real to anybody else. He seems like a vision to Big Bird. I think Grover would be the one.
He's definitely got a good cover.
Yeah.
Wait, I mean, no one would suspect.
Sure.
Snuffleupagus?
I had no idea he was a figure.
Well, he's not really.
He isn't anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
He was when we were kids, but I think someone determined that having him invisible to adults made him... encouraged kids who were victims of sexual abuse to keep their secrets.
Oh, my God.
Some psychologists.
Well, because that show...
So now everyone could see Mr. Snuffleupagus.
If you...
It seems...
Not a fan anymore. Now that everyone's into it.
Yeah.
It used to piss me off so much as a kid that no one... I think it did... There was a small bit of childhood trauma when every time he'd be like, he was just here, and they were like, oh, Big Bird, you're dumb. They're like, God damn it, he was right fucking there, and you don't give him the...
Yeah.
You'd be horrible at watching, like, Blue's Clues or something like that. It's fucking like, right behind you!
It's like the reverse of the rage I would feel when I would say, hey, Kool-Aid!
Yes. And nothing would happen.
Nothing.
That was false advertising. Yeah. It didn't happen, though. That was false advertising.
I know. He never came through.
Yeah, that used to drive me up the fucking wall. Well, I'm glad that they...
So you're always a real worked up guy, huh?
Yeah, I've always been a very worked up guy. Always. Just tightly wound. I was a very tightly wound kid.
Right. Mm.
Do you
do anything to counteract that? Do you like...
Well, I drank all through my 20s. And then
good
I had...
way to do it.
Yeah, that's a common
That's a common way
tactic.
To deal with that. Yeah, and then after that, I was like, well, I guess I think... The older you get, the less energy you have to really be that tightly wound all the time.
Yeah.
Because it just requires an enormous amount of...
That's a good way to put a positive spin on aging, you know? It's like, I just want to get the tired enough to not be bothered.
Oh, someday.
How do you feel about it? How do you feel? Because we both hit the same milestone last year.
Right.
How
the did you... big 4-2.
I'm 28. How do you...
I don't know. It's weird. I mean, especially with Dexter. I started that when I was 34, 5, and it just... Zip. Oh, yeah. It keeps going faster.
It does keep going faster.
People are like, you're not old. I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely not young.
Yeah. No, we're in the in-between part right now. Yeah,
Existence period.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
The everyday life of things.
Well, it's not until you get to about 38 where you go, there's an end point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm halfway there. You know, like that's sort of a bizarre existential. Because when you're in your, all the way up until about 35, you really just, everything feels infinite, I think.
And in terms of your perspective on time, you're so much closer to your death, even if you live to be 90.
Yeah.
In terms of the percentage that you have left and how much, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
and the
right?
quality of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then also all those things where you start going, oh, shit, I guess I better not. You get very precious about not just wasting time because it sort of feels like I really better if there are things I'm going to do, I should probably do those while I'm still capable.
Yeah, just keep working, Chris. Just fill your days up with
but
work.
But a lot of things I want to do are work things, Jonah.
Oh, yeah.
Not like going in the Appalachian Trail, which sounds fucking awesome.
Yeah, that's not a waste of time.
Not at all. Are you gonna camp along the way?
Is that yeah, what? Yeah. It's like 7 days. And yeah, we'll be camping throughout.
Is it a relatively carved path that you, or is it?
Honestly, kind of... the plans are materializing as we speak. So it's, I don't know exactly, but it's the Appalachian Trail is definitely, you know,
people have been on it.
It's yeah, we're not Lewis and Clarking anything.
No machetes. Man, I wish that was a verb. I totally Lewis and Clark that mountain trail.
I just made my own rule there. You can do it.
You can do whatever you want.
Lewis and Clarking isn't that when you have sex with a virgin?
Yeah, that's right. Actor Michael C. Hall ate three of his compatriots while on. Oh, see, I'm back into the radio voice again.
Yeah.
Have you thought about like?
And Lewis and Clark the third. No.
Have you thought about what? Have you thought about like? You're just planning this stuff now. You don't even know yet. I didn't know that was even an option of just like, oh, you could just go on the Appalachian Trail.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, you say you don't want to waste time when you get older, and that's true. But then you're left with like, okay, so what is and isn't a waste of time?
Yeah, your whole idea of like, oh, well, if I just sit around all day, that's wasting time. But if you sit around all day and you're in the middle of nature and you're building something or you're doing something fun and experiencing it on that, then that's not wasting time.
Yeah, kind of still is.
No, it's not.
It's all a waste. Everything's a waste of time.
We're all wasting time right now.
I think we're killing time.
When you kill time, you murder success.
That doesn't even mean anything.
Something a guy told me once.
That doesn't even mean anything.
When you kill time, you murder success. If you're just killing time, you're not doing anything productive. Therefore, you don't succeed at anything. Therefore, you murder success.
How many lines of coke did that guy finish before he told you that?
Not as many as me.
I don't think that's a coke line. I think that's a pot dealer line. I don't think that's a coke line.
Mm.
Anything could be a coke line if you say it enough times
in a row. And fast
No. Because when you kill time, you're killing, you're murdering success.
Time's gone.
Tom Petty. Tom Petty.
Yes. Heartbreakers.
You just keep saying Tom Petty when you're on coke?
That's my theory of cocaine. If you do it enough times, you will end up in a bathroom talking about Tom Petty with some guy.
Right. Yeah.
That was my line about Newsroom. It's so nice to hear Aaron Sorkin's opinions on the news without having to do coke with him.
But I think if you're watching the show, you are doing coke with him.
Yeah, kind of. Except it's more meaningful. You know, Newsroom.
Have you ever done it?
No.
Me neither.
No, I'm too afraid.
Me too.
It's a great drug.
I don't. What?
It's a drug. If they're all great, it's just.
I don't know if that's
everything
accurate.
Everything else about them is the worst. The actual doing of them. That's why people love them, Chris. That's why people can't get away. Because of how awesome they are. There's no doubt that they're great.
Yeah, if they were
that's
bad,
that's great. That's so refreshing. Oh, it's a terrible drug.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the more it destroys people's lives, I guess the better it probably is. I mean,
it's an inverse relationship.
Yeah.
It's inversely proportional.
Yeah.
The amount that it will destroy you is inversely proportional to how bad it is.
Correct.
Have you done it a bunch?
Yeah, sure.
What?
Not for a long time, but yeah, I've done coke a bunch.
What are you like on coke?
More of same.
Yeah, more of same. Just I have a lot of ideas. It's like the thing is when you're on cocaine, it's you're about to figure everything out, but you're just never there.
Yeah.
But doesn't
and you feel like when you're doing coke with friends and stuff like that, you feel that if you just keep on doing coke and keep on talking, you're gonna get there. That's the feeling you have of that suspense of just like if we just keep going, we're gonna fucking
I've never heard it described that way.
Yeah. That's the fun part of it, you know.
Let's do a coke episode.
Never.
Where we all take coke.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Could you be prosecuted for that?
No, it's an episode.
And it's gross, you know. And like the more you're doing cocaine, the more you feel like you can drink. And so that's like, you know, makes the next day even worse.
I would die. I would instantly die. I can't even drink a cup of coffee. I can't even drink caffeinated. This is decaf. I can't. If I drank caffeinated coffee, you would have to take me to the hospital.
You don't need that.
Because I would, it already feels.
You know, I mean, you're one of those people who doesn't need coffee.
Yeah, no.
You know, there are those people.
Yeah, I like a trace amount of caffeine, but that's about it.
Chris, think about all the other stuff you can get done.
Oh shit!
Stop wasting your time. Think about what you could do if you're not sleeping.
Hey guys, I've started 19 websites in the last 48 hours.
that extra 3 hours of sleep you could get, not sleeping, you would just. It's so much get done. Come on. Let's do it. Let's do a coke episode.
No.
We'll call it a very special episode of Nerdist.
Yeah.
very special and boldface. It'll never happen.
You'd figure something out.
We'd almost crack that code.
Talk over each other even more.
Well, we almost got a guy today, but just keep listening.
Tune in tomorrow. We might get it.
But then we'll get it.
Why tune in tomorrow? Let's just keep going.
We'll all get in tune. We'll all do like the gulp in the middle of us, and everyone will be talking. We'll go, and then we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
I didn't feel like there was a lot of listening on that show.
Tim Kazurinsky, a former SNL cast member, says this about cocaine. He says it gives you diarrhea of the mouth but constipation of the brain.
Hey, that's
which
pretty,
I think
that's
is a pretty spot on.
Do you think we ever?
He's not the one who was talking about murdering time.
No, that wasn't him. Yeah.
You
think it was Charlie Rocket?
You think we get enough shit now about saying that we talk over each other? If we're fucking cocaine, it would just be a chorus of separate ideas all being expressed at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. In counterpoint.
Yeah, there's a lot of no, yes.
Today we're going to make a lot of statements, and then tomorrow we're going to contradict all of those statements
and
have just equally as compelling arguments.
The apology episode. Listen, we said a lot of things.
We've never done like a full apology episode.
Yeah. I like to feel that every episode is an apology episode.
Yeah. The come down.
If we had left some of the things I've said in, you would have to.
What are you talking about, man? Never edited anything you've ever.
Edit that out.
You don't listen to the podcast, you don't know this, but there was a recent episode, the one where Peter Farrelly was on and you guys did this whole show when I took him, walked him to his car, and you go, oh, Chris is going to edit that out.
Oh, yeah.
I cut out a second of something that Jonah said, so it sounded edited.
Oh, nice.
Why'd you have to pick me? I was the other one that had to get edited out. Because knowing me, it was probably really funny.
Well, favorite. I'm the fan favorite, so.
There are no fan favorites anymore.
Yeah, there are. Not me and Jonah.
Guys, we have guests.
Sorry, Michael. Welcome. We peeked behind the curtain here. It's just.
I'm sorry. I fell asleep for a second. What are you guys talking about?
So did the listeners.
No, I'll cut all that out.
So did whoever just reviewed this for the AV Club.
Stop getting. Don't focus on that shit. You don't focus on that stuff, do you?
AV Club?
Do you. Do you go online and read stuff, or do you not?
I don't. I try not to seek it out. But if somebody puts something in front of my face, it's
why do you think they do that? You know,
that.
Like when they go, "Oh my God, can you believe what this person said about you?" Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, I lose respect for those people.
You hear that, Jonah? I didn't need that email this morning.
I don't know. I was in a bad mood this morning. I was in a bad mood.
I wonder what that mechanism is. Where like, I think people like being. You know what it is? People. It gives them a certain sense of significance if they deliver the thing to you.
Right.
They go, look at this. I'm helping you out. You're like, no, you just ruined my day.
Yeah. Did you see that terrible picture of you?
It was really bad.
Here, I'll pull it up.
Here, I'll pull it up.
I didn't think it was that bad. Oh, it's really bad.
No, it's bad. Look at, yeah.
Are you a relatively positive person, do you think?
No.
You don't think so?
No, I'm a... I don't know that I'm a pessimist. I don't know. I guess I think I sort of cultivate a sort of pessimistic buffer.
Sure.
But I hold on to some sort of optimism that I don't totally own up to.
Sure.
For fear of my dreams being squashed.
Yes. That's it. Is the pessimism thing gives it, because I think particularly with performers, you know, even though you've been working for the last 13 years, a significant chunk of your performing life, there was rejection. And maybe there are still forms of rejection that you still experience now if there are other things that you want to do or they don't work out or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think not only do we get conditioned to accept that, but it definitely allows you to control the outcome when you're like, well, this is all going to go to shit anyway. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a weird control thing.
Yeah, there's some. I mean, I'd like to believe that underneath that veneer, there's a more sort of hopeful nugget.
Yeah.
But I do think I do, you know, what is it? Hope for the best, expect the worst.
I guess. Do you think that means that we'll get crankier as we get older? Or do you think that it is?
I don't know.
God damn it, Michael! My dad used to be a really serious, kind of like in his own head guy all the time. And then as he got older, he just like, he's all gushy and like really like, oh, life is great, you know, like I really hope that's what happens,
the trajectory. Yeah. I guess you go one of two directions, you know. I don't know. I hope I think I fantasized like there being some sort of release associated with old age before the final release.
Right, 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 right.
You're talking about the butt plug?
Yeah.
Before rubber shorts.
Well, it's like that. It's like that scene. Oh, is that your guy?
Oh, is he? Yeah.
It looked like he was
LA
like
Times
doing
thing.
A cutthroat.
I think he was saying.
Thank God you know
that what he did. Yeah. I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Thank God you know that guy. I just thought, like, who is that guy that's telling us to wrap it up? Yeah. Hey, you guys, I don't like how long you've been in there. I really do hope that's the case, but it's like that Jason Robards speech in Parenthood where he's saying to Steve Martin, like, you never cross the finish line. You never spike the touchdown ball. That depressed me so much when I was a kid.
Yeah, cruel.
Because I really do hope that there is that, like, but maybe we're just not conditioned.
It's kind of like he's talking about conversations on cocaine.
Yeah, that's true. You
never get there.
Dad, are you coked up? What is it? What if I am?
Life is cocaine. All right, thanks.
Was there anything else you wanted to promote or plug while you're here before we leave?
Do you want to promote Sorbet?
I'm doing Kill Your Darlings, a movie.
Oh, yeah, the movie Kill Your Darlings.
Comes out in October.
Excellent.
It's good. It's about a story about the seminal event during the forming of the Beat Generation. Remarkably, a story that hasn't been told until now. So based on a true story, it's really a... And my character is... it's not really a spoiler because it's the first frame of the film. Dies. So I got to turn the tables on myself.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was fun.
Cool.
Nice.
And death has to be involved in everything.
In some way or another. No, you're going to do like some really silly, you know...
Rom-com.
Some kind of rom-com. You ever want to do something like that? Like silly and light?
Yeah. Yeah. But...
we'll get right on that.
I do. I mean, this has felt reasonably silly.
It is. It is. We try to have some substance to it.
I just... There it is. I just want to say...
For the listeners at home,
that's the new Enjoy Your Burrito.
That might have been the silliest thing that's ever fucking happened on this podcast. And Dunham was so stoic. Just hold on.
That actually sounds like a Geico commercial. Well, that's sillier than Michael C. Hall doing arm farts. Well, see you at Comic-Con, possibly. Is Ralph Garman moderating your panel this year?
I believe so.
He's great.
From the Showbiz Beat?
Yeah, from Showbiz. Yeah, Ralph's great.
From Hollywood Babylon.
Well, have fun at Comic-Con, and thanks for coming on, and I hope you had a nice time.
You're welcome. I'd shake all your hands, but it was just in my armpits.
It's just covered in armpit sweat.
Understood.
Oh, I just remembered, I met you last year at Sarah Silverman's party with Ben Schwartz, who is hilarious. Like,
he's
one
hilarious.
Of the funniest people you could possibly
Amazing.
Know.
Yeah, I love that guy.
Have you done his snow pants show before?
I have.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He was telling me that.
Yeah, it's horrifying. I just, you know, basically, I was the go-to burst into tears and masturbate guy. You know, because my first thing out
Nothing's
there.
Nothing's funnier.
The
Nothing's funnier than crying and masturbating.
It's like, I don't know what to do.
This will get him.
Great choice for the show. What show? The end.
Thanks, guys.
Enjoy your brew.
That was awesome.
That was fun.
Thanks, man. I hope you had an okay time.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, that's right.
I don't know if you're like...
You're holding it like your hand is broken.
It looks like it's affecting your hand. All right, that was fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.